We could go for the questions. We have a few on our chat. So the first one is to all of you, to all speakers. There's one question from audience. Do any of the speakers see a connection between CCP political influence and China's Arctic interests? So maybe Frank, if you are still online, or anyone from the first panel.
Sure, if I may. Very good example, you know, I was also, very good question. I was also surprised that China is so much interested in Iceland or even in Estonia. We are rather small countries. But of course, our location has significance if you think about how important geopolitically is the Arctic region. And Estonia also has been, offered the chance to build Tallinn-Helsinki tunnel in the Baltic Sea, and Finland also was proposed the plan to build the Arctic Railway connecting the far north of Finland or even Norway and Finnish railway system that could, one day, if these all projects implemented, could reach from the Arctic down to Berlin in Germany. So, of course, location is of importance, and countries, who are very well aware of the Russia threat or Russia's presence or closeness should also think about broadly about where do they exactly are situated on the map.
Thank you very much, Frank. Maybe Dr. Brennan or Parniren would like to add something? React to this question. Maybe I can repeat it once more. There's someone asking from audience, do any of the speakers see connection between CCP political influence and China's Arctic interests?
Well, I can just shortly point out that the concept of the Arctic has not come up in the groups that I've been studying, so they certainly don't seem to be that interested in the Arctic region or China's Arctic strategy. But that definitely doesn't mean that the party would not have interest in that area. It surely does, and it has an Arctic strategy, and it's an observer in the Arctic Council and so on. But I think Frank has been doing research on these issues much more than me. For example, he's been studying the Arctic cable, the Arctic Connect concept, and the issues involved in that. So I would guess that he would be better equipped to answer that question.
Thank you very much for this. I can see that Professor Tonami-san is waving to me, so please, floor is yours.
Thank you. My question goes to other panelists. Thanks once again for very interesting presentation. And it seems the kind of a common thread here is that all cases show some kind of openness from the receiving side for the Chinese money or capital. This definitely, it's not one way, it's mutual, right? So let's say, for example, in the case of Sweden, where the companies have stopped receiving money from the Chinese company and whatnot, how does did it have any kind of repercussion to Swedish economy? Because obviously there was a need for that money, but now that money is gone or is not coming. And how is let's say Sweden or Estonia or wherever, which stopped receiving money, reacting to that new reality with no money?
Okay, thank you for the question. I think Frank is waving. So Frank, please, if you would like to answer.
Yes, I would like to. There's a very popular narrative in Estonia that in order to have access or in order to enter the Chinese market, you have to spend a lot of time, you have to establish a lot of contacts in order to finally reach the promised land in a way. So, but to great extent, all these promises have so far not materialized. So in a way, China is very good at selling this Chinese dream of having access or having great economic relations. For what I've heard about most of the Central Eastern European countries, this has just remained a promise. But a very interesting aspect, if you think about people who have spent their time and invested their money into having access to the market, of course, they are reluctant to change the rhetoric or even start thinking in a different way. But if you think about the Chinese influence activities, this for them seems like a win-win opportunity without spending nothing in order to have the local elites, local politicians, local businessmen do the not the propaganda work or do the promotion of Chinese market instead of you. So I mean, like this is a serious problem that needs to be addressed.
Thank you, Frank. Bar is waving to me, so please, Barney Renan.
Yeah. So just. So just generally, I think there's been a rethink in Sweden as well as in other countries about how we think about investments in from China and in critical sectors. So there's both growing awareness in companies, but also slowly but surely also from the government. So we don't yet have a screening system in Sweden, but it's something that the government is working on, and they'll put forward a proposal for that at the latest in November next year. So there's still some way to go. But I think in all of these issues, when it comes to the weaponization of the Chinese market, it's in the Swedish case, it's we have a Chinese ambassador here who is quite vocal about using the Chinese market access as leverage, but so far we haven't seen that clear measures. So it's a lot of talk, but at the end of the day, Chinese sanctions towards other countries, hurts the Chinese economy as well. So I think Sweden and other countries would do well to remain cool in these sort of situations and not be too risk averse in these sort of situations.
Yeah. Thank you. I can see that Didi would like to maybe ask or add something, and then we have a question for Dr. Puranen later on. So Didi.
Citizen of a small European country, I often hear this narrative like, why would China be interested in us? We're small. Frank, you just mentioned Estonia. We've got Finland and other places too, with relatively small populations. Czech Republic might be another one. But I think the point here is not how big is the country in Europe, for example, but that no country is too small because of Chinese internal party and bureaucracy pressures create a kind of internal bureaucratic competition for promotion, for performance, for acknowledgement from Beijing. So anybody working in Estonia, in Finland, in the foreign affairs system or in other systems or in Beijing with special responsibility for these systems in Europe, no matter how small the country, will seek results. And this then is, I think, a reason why there's really no country too small, I think is the point. And it's not that, was so incredibly important, even though it's only got 5 million people. No, it's because the pressure within China, within the Chinese system, among its representatives overseas, to perform for Beijing, to bring results back home. So documentation spotting systems globally that are run out of China, people through smaller countries. So again, I think the basic message there is that, one doesn't want to paint too much of a big, scary system or anything like that. Let's not go overboard. We have many ways of dealing with this, I believe, if we had the political will. At the same time, I think it is important to remember that it's kind of a case of no country too small to be of interest. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Now, I would like to ask Frank, I think Frank was waving, that he would like to add something. And then there's this last question for Dr. Puranen. So Frank, please. Frank, excuse me, do you want to add something?
Sorry, my microphone was off. Sorry. Yes, I wanted to add that I totally agree with Didis. What she said is that no country is too small, and we shouldn't make ourselves smaller in the eyes of China. Because, for instance, Estonia is a member of NATO and EU, and in case of EU, you just need one EU member state to, oppose sanctions, joint sanctions against China and Uyghurs or Hong Kong. So, you know, every vote or every member counts. So,
yes. Oh, is right. Thank you. I think our time is running. So last question I will announce for Dr. Puranen. It's from the audience, and there's someone asking if Doctor could you elaborate on the background of Li Dai? So Dr. Puranen, if you are still here, can you answer, please? Yeah. Thank you.
Elaborate on which one was the liaison department?
No, Li Dai.
Ah, Li Dai. Yes. The story is interesting because he was invited to Finland pretty soon after this Real Max company was established in Finland. Before he was invited, a delegation from Finland led by Mika Niikko and some other representatives of the Real Max company traveled to Beijing to meet with Li Dai they met at some university. I have to check out which university it was. You can maybe read it from the report later on. But anyway, they met with Li Dai in Beijing, in one of the Beijing universities. And pretty soon after that, so 2 or 3 months later, Li Dai was invited to visit Helsinki, which he did. And so we don't know much about his doings in here, but at least he visited the Finnish parliament with Mika Niikko for some reason, I don't know why. And then they had some discussions on cooperation, probably through the Real Max company on artificial intelligence and augmented reality and stuff like that. And from public sources, it's not easy to find out it's not announced that he is indeed a major general of the People's Liberation Army. And Elisa Kania, the researcher Elisa Kania, she has written on Li Dai and his place within the Chinese military technology research cluster. So you just should Google Elisa Kania and Li Dai, and there would be some interesting stuff about him.
Thank you very much for your answer. Later on, how I mentioned, we are going to have the whole presentation online and also with the links. I think now we have 10 minutes for coffee break and trying to solve our last technical issues. So please, thank you very much, all our speakers who were here with us during the first panel. And we will meet in 10 minutes where we are going to continue with the case studies too. With examples from Czech Republic, Lithuania, Poland. So please stay tuned, and now let's have a coffee. Thank you all.